Good morning. Welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for our program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Henry Frain is at the controls. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about the federal budget. And certainly one thing that I expect we're going to be talking about is debt. In the first half of this budget year, the federal deficit hit an all-time high, $311 billion, and it is projected to go even higher by year's end. And in response, the White House and the Congress have just kept spending money. We'll talk a little bit this morning about the federal budget, where the money goes, and one question we certainly want to ask is why it is so difficult to control spending. And our guest for the program is Scott Frisch. He is professor of political science and chair at California State University, Channel Islands. His area of expertise include Congress, public budgeting, and public policy. Before becoming a college professor, he worked in Washington, D.C. for the U.S. Department of the Treasury. He worked as an analyst for the Office of Management and Budget and also as a legislative fellow for U.S. Senator Frank Lautenberg. He's the author of the book The Politics of Pork and co-author of Committee Assignment Politics in the U.S. House of Representatives. And he's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. At any point here, people want to get involved in the conversation, they certainly are welcome to call. We just ask that callers keep their questions and comments brief, so we can keep our program moving along and get in as many different people as possible. But certainly, everyone who is listening, anyone who is listening, is welcome to call. Professor Frisch, hello.
Good morning, David. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us. We certainly appreciate it. There are a number of different things that I want to talk about. And maybe the way to start would be something like this, if you could give us a kind of an audio pie chart and just talk a little bit about what the major, where when you look at the major slices of the pie, where the money goes, what are, how that breaks down, and particularly, I guess, the thing we want to focus on is the amount, the percentage of the federal budget that is truly discretionary, where Congress or the president or anybody actually have some say into how much money is spent.
Great, sure thing. As far as the federal spending side of the equation, we spend about $3 trillion a year. And about two-thirds, or a little more than two-thirds of that, is off-limits for discretionary spending. It's things that are entitlements, interest on the debt, things we call mandatory spending that year after year we are obligated to spend money on and really can't control as part of the appropriations process. It would take a change of federal law, a change in the Social Security system or Medicare or one of the big entitlement programs in order to limit that slice of the pie. So the big slice of the pie is the mandatory spending, is the entitlement programs and the interest on the debt, and that really can't be controlled every year. And so we're down to less than a third, so it's less than $1 trillion of $3 trillion that is discretionary. And of that third that's remaining, the $900 billion in change, more than half of that, about $515 billion, is in the defense segment. And so when we start getting down to what we're going to cut and where we're going to eliminate programs, it gets really hard to find big targets in terms of lots of money and lots of dollars.
Mm-hmm. And I guess it's worth mentioning, as I'm sure someone would if we didn't, that in the current budget, the defense portion does not include the costs of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Right. Those are handled actually separately through supplemental appropriations, the political calculation being such that the war is an emergency, needs to be dealt with separately, handled and on a different track and a different timeline. And so that does not get included in that defense-based number that I was talking about. Yeah, that's right.
It's my understanding that since 1970, there were only 4 years in all of this period where the government did not run a deficit.
Mm-hmm.
1998 through 2001. Otherwise, we'd had deficits in all these other years. Last year, it was only $162 billion. this year already, I think the number that I mentioned was 311, and I think even the Office of Management and Budget is saying it's going to be more than $400 million this year. So considerable increase from last year to this, and I suppose partly you can explain that by the serious downturn in the economy and the costs of particularly the war in Iraq. But, you know, having said all that, is this really... You can look at the expenditure side, you can look at the revenue side, and obviously both of those things are important. But when you look at where we are now, and particularly this significant deficits we're running, is that can one say that it's more of a spending problem or more of a revenue problem, or does that just sort of depend on who you ask?
I think it's the latter. It depends on who you ask, and it breaks down pretty nicely, usually around the political parties, where Republicans have historically been the party saying we tax too much, we need to cut taxes, and then we have to find spending cuts to offset those tax cuts. The Democrats have been much more likely to say that it's a revenue shortage and we need more income coming into the government to deal with the problem, more taxes. And the Bush tax cuts in particular is something you didn't mention as having an impact on the size of the deficit this year and in past years. And that's something that, in addition to the economic downturn, and the spending on the war has to be factored into it, because when you cut taxes, you often end up having a lot less revenue than you need in order to pay your bills.
Well, and I did want to bring that up, and I guess that indeed the question in my mind was to what extent have those tax cuts contributed to the place that we are now, particularly with this very significant deficit and jump in the deficit from last year to this.
Yeah, I think all three factors play a role. I don't think it was the tax cuts alone, certainly, but the tax cuts did have an impact. If you look at revenues actually declined after the tax cuts, and they've been increasing since then, but not at a pace to sustain the level of spending that's just a necessary consequence of population growth and inflation.
I think that I'm sure I know from time to time, if I've had the opportunity to talk about budget issues with economists or political scientists or people of whatever academic background, I'm sure many times I've asked this question: do deficits matter? How worried should we be about the fact that we've been running these deficits now low these many years, and now it's certainly bigger this year than last? Let me put that question to you and see what kind of answer you'd give.
Well, I'm a political scientist, not an economist. That being said, yeah, they matter. They matter because when we borrow, we have to pay that back over time with interest, just like anyone else, and that cuts into future spending. And when we start looking at this mandatory spending part of the pie, one of the big segments, you know, 12-13% every year off the top is our debt. We have to finance our interest payments on what we borrowed in the past. So that crowds out, that takes away what we can spend in the future. It also has a lot of uncertain impacts in terms of who we borrow money from, and has lots of impacts in terms of international relations and what other countries and citizens in other countries own that debt, because really when it's public debt, it is, you know, anyone who wants to buy it can. And so there are lots of impacts that go along with it. Do I lose sleep over it overnight? Probably not, in terms of the size of the overall deficit. There are some economic reasons that deficits in some years are positive things, but overall I think it's a negative impact. And certainly when we're borrowing so much money and crowding out other borrowers in the market, it has an impact.
Mm-hmm. Something that I really want to focus in on has to do with the how it is we spend that one-third of the budget that's the discretionary stuff.
Sure.
With the entitlements, that other two-third, essentially we know what that is. We have a fairly good idea what it is from year to year and where the money goes. That's relatively speaking, although people have done funny things with the numbers, that seems to be fairly transparent.
Mm-hmm.
The one big issue, I think, for a lot of people is the what we do about that other third, and the excluding defense. And the question I think a lot of people raise is, it does have to do with transparency and being able to know where the money is going, what it's going for, and who in Congress is the initiator of that? Who's really sort of behind that? And that gets us, I suppose, into a conversation about earmarks and maybe there are other things as well. And I guess, though, just as a general kind of question, do you think that we have transparency problems with how it is we decide where that one-third, that discretionary money in the budget, where that goes?
Sure. I teach a course in public budgeting, and I have to teach my students how to track where that money goes. And it should be something that should be straightforward enough for the typical citizen, the typical taxpayer, to pick up documents and look at it. It shouldn't be spread out in 12 different appropriations reports. It shouldn't be a way where the president submits his budget, but that's really a request, and then Congress comes up with a number of bills to put that request into law, which are very difficult to find, and then there's no budget at the end of the process where people actually see, okay, this is what we actually spent money on. So it is very, very difficult, and it takes someone like me often to train people where to find where we spend our money on.
Mm. Is that something that you think is amenable to reform? Certainly there are some people who are really concerned about that.
Well, as far as the earmark question that you mentioned before, there has been a lot of progress in the past year. And there now are, in each of these 12 Appropriations Committee reports, listing of project by project where we're spending the earmarked segment of the budget. So that's some progress. But still, the vast majority of spending is not earmarked. And I hope we'll get into that, because most of it is dealt with through formula grants or project grants. That is often very, very difficult to track ultimately where the money is being spent.
Okay. Well, we have a caller here I want to get to, and other people who are listening, certainly you're welcome to call with questions. And let me introduce again our guest, Scott Frisch. He's professor of political science and chair at Cal State University Channel Islands. He is interested in Congress, in public budgeting, and public policy. We're talking a little bit here this morning about the federal budget and what it is and how it gets put together. And questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. And we have one caller here to start us off in Kane County, Elburn, line number 4. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. Good topic. I kind of follow this, and having worked for the federal government in the past, I got an idea of what you're talking about. I got a couple of comments and a question I got, I guess. One of my comments would be, I used to work for the Forest Service years ago. I had about 18, 19 years in with them. And it used to be, and I want to say it's been about 15 years or so, but I have people, friends of mine, still work there. They're budgeting, and their, I should say, the monies that they get at the end of the day is far less, greater than people think. And I've, having grown up in the Northwest, people in the Midwest seem to think that, oh, they don't need the money when they do. There are projects out there currently being worked on that I think the priorities have been forgotten in this country. We're spending way too much money in areas that ought not to be. Like, for instance, why do we need a space station? How many billions of dollars are we spending there? And the reason I bring the Forest Service up, it for some reason gets left out in the cold. I think it's at the bottom of the list, what I call the food chain when it comes to budgets. They're running on minimal, like skeleton crews, every year to try and take care of some of our national parks and our national forests. And people wonder why things are in such disarray. Having been there, I could tell you it takes a lot of manpower hours to work on this. My question for you would be, it seems like there's no priorities when it comes to set except for the war. The war seems to be taking a lot of the money, and I'm dead set against this. I think our budget process is being, and I know this for a fact, I know somebody has told me that works for the federal government, and some of the monies that normally would go to these other projects like the Forest Service and the NASA and other things are being taken out and being diverted to the war. Is that true?
If you look at the federal budget since 2001, the two areas that have actually gone down in terms of dollar amounts, so not even inflation adjusted, but literal dollar amounts, have been in agriculture, where the Forest Service is, and in environmental and in interior, where most of the other environmental kinds of agencies are. And I think it just reflects the priorities of those who are in power. And for much of that period, it's been a Republican president with a Republican Congress, and with a war and with Homeland Security being more of a pressing issue for them, other areas have suffered a net decline in terms of revenue. So if you look at the raw numbers, sure, it looks like that there's been a decrease in these areas.
The other question I would have is that is this typical of a Republican president or a Democratic president? Because it seems to me, I want to say 8-10 years ago, we almost had the same problem. To me, there's got to be a different way than using taxpayer money to fund some of these projects. You got to let it out, let the people decide instead of them deciding. To me, it makes absolutely no sense anymore with modern times, with the cost of living. We're spending gobs of money, and it seems like we don't get what we, you know, our services rendered. And I'll get off and listen. Thanks, guys. Have a great week.
We have a political process, and we elect officials, and historically we've had really a battle between the president and Congress, really dating back from the first Congress, about who controls spending and how much it should be and what we should be spending on. And ultimately, the budget we have is determined through that process. And, you know, is it Republican or Democrat? Well, look at what your local elective officials are doing. Look what the president is proposing. And then I guess you have to make your own choice as a voter in terms of who to support. But the budget is a product. It's not neat and clean and easy. There's lots of people compromising. There's lots of people advocating for programs. There's lots of interest groups who want to spend money on different things. You may or may not agree with them. But it's a messy process, but it's what we end up with at the end of the day.
And I guess my question would be, hasn't it always been like that? There's only so much money. Mm-hmm. There isn't the money to spend on all of the things that we would all like to spend it on. So there's got to be some sort of process. And there's always going to be, I would expect, always going to be some persons or people or groups who are saying, well, we really think that the priorities here are all screwed up, and we're not spending the money on the things that we should. So there's always going to be somebody who's saying, you know, I think my project was really important and was more important than this guy over here, but he got the money.
Yeah, and really from the very beginning, there have been kind of two questions. And the first question is, should we as a federal government, as a national government, be spending money on these projects that have mainly local benefits, the kinds of things we call earmarks or pork barrel spending? And for much of American history, really up through the New Deal, we decided against that, and presidents in particular used the veto pen, really, to prevent lots of government spending on programs that had not general benefits, but localized benefits. Since the New Deal, and then really escalating dramatically in the Great Society and Lyndon Johnson, we've had a dramatic growth in the number and size and scope of the different programs that are out there in terms of what we would now call pork or localized benefit spending programs, whatever you want to call them. So then once we've decided, okay, as a society, we're doing that, and really there's a bipartisan consensus that we're going to spend federal funds on local projects, the question then becomes, who gets to decide where the money's going to be spent? Is it the president or is it Congress? And there's been a battle about that, really, since we started spending at the level that we do. And that's the battle that's going on right now in terms of earmarks between President Bush and the Congress.
Yeah, that and again, I guess I find myself going back to this transparency issue that says, you know, well, one man's pork is another man's constituent service. Mm-hmm. But at the very least, you would say that it ought to be, the process ought to be open enough so that we know where the money's going and who it is that is sponsoring that particular piece of legislation that's going to take some federal money and put it into one state for one particular purpose. And right. I guess do you think that if this was a more open process and we dealt with things like soft earmarks, where you're not really quite sure who's sponsoring what, mm-hmm. or other things that don't involve earmarks but still make it difficult to know who's behind particular kinds of spending, would that indeed make a difference if somehow at least it was a more open sort of process?
I think it'll make a difference in terms of the sort of preventing incidents like the Duke Cunningham situation where a member of Congress was actually receiving bribes to put earmarks in bills that no one could find and know about. So those kinds of issues certainly would be exposed. The other idea is that if members of Congress have their earmarks see the light of day, that they won't do that, I think is kind of faulty logic, because I think members of Congress really want their constituents who vote for them to see the earmarks. They put them out in press releases, they have newsletters, they trumpet them when they're on the campaign trail. So those are kind of open already. It's just getting the public information on all that's out there and what goes on behind it and how much money is and who gets what, which is really one of the reforms that was enacted in this Congress. So for the first time, we do have a complete list of all the hard earmarks, the ones that have a zip code, a dollar amount, and a specific member of Congress associated. I think that was a great reform in terms of allowing the public to know what's going on and prevent the kinds of outright corruption that Cunningham engaged in. But as far as the idea that if we just expose them to the light of day, we're going to embarrass members into not doing it, I don't think that's going to happen, and I think the evidence shows that it didn't.
Just one quick question, and I have callers we're going to get to. What's the, relatively speaking, how much money are we talking about in each of the two kinds of earmarks, the hard and the soft?
The hard is real easy to find and track, and the OMB, the Office of Management and Budget, said that this current year in the budget we're operating right now, there was $16.8 billion in hard earmarks, and that means about 11,000 to 12,000 different projects. As far as the soft earmarks, when there isn't a specific member object and reporting requirement, no one knows, because they're so difficult to find and they're so difficult to identify and add up the dollar amounts. Often the soft earmark doesn't even say how much money it is. It says the Forest Service is encouraged to do X, Y, and Z. Well, the Foreign Service is going to do it because it's in a report language that Congress has said, and if they don't, then next year in their appropriations process, they're going to suffer some kind of penalty. But there's no real way of figuring out how many dollars are there and how many different projects are there.
We have another callers, and we'll go next to Bloomington, Illinois, and this is our toll-free line, line 4.
Good
Hello.
Morning.
Yes.
The federal deficit is just one component of the federal debt, and your guest is likely aware, David Walker, the former Comptroller General of the United States, has been on a tour lately talking to anyone who will listen, warning citizens that balancing the federal budget by the year 2040 would require either A, cutting the total federal spending by 60%, or B, doubling the federal tax rates. The alternative, of course, to balancing the budget is printing more money, but that could very well result in the dollar being abandoned as the world's reserve currency. I wonder if your caller shares this concern.
I don't think I'm as gloomy as David Walker is, but I certainly am not optimistic, and I think that whoever the next president is, a lot of people say, why would you want to be president now? And one of the reasons is not just the war, but it has to do with dealing with this ongoing situation. It really is structurally unsustainable, and something has to happen in terms of the spending side, the revenue side, and the entitlement side. We haven't really talked much about the entitlements other than to say they're hard to control, but they're this part of the long-run budgetary future of the United States. I didn't lose sleep overnight about the size of the deficit. What I lose sleep over is the size of Medicare and how quickly it's growing and how quickly it's outpacing inflation and how hard of a problem that one is to deal with societally. So these are big problems. These are not small problems. I didn't want to minimize it earlier on when I say don't lose sleep over it. But there are ways that can be done, but the sooner they're done, the better in terms of dealing with them. The longer you put it off, the more pain that has to be suffered.
Well, indeed, Medicare is a large part of the federal obligation, and it could be the thing that breaks the camel's back. Why are you more optimistic than David Walker? Just get off the leave it there.
I think it just depends on how you look at the numbers and where you come from at it politically, and I've seen situations where before the Clinton administration, people were saying, well, there's no way to control the deficit, and it is politically impossible to raise taxes and cut spending. And really, if you look at what happened with first in President Bush's administration with the Budget Enforcement Act in 1990, and then the Clinton administration's first budget, serious reforms were enacted, and they put caps on spending, which I think is something that really needs to be done in terms of controlling. That's the only way we found to control spending is put actual dollar number caps on each of the discretionary spending categories. And it also put a pay-go system, a pay-as-you-go system in place for revenues and for entitlements. So if you're going to cut taxes, you're going to have to find a way to offset that in terms of revenues. Otherwise, you're going to end up with an exacerbated situation. So I've seen politically a situation where people were doom and gloom, and an economic boom combined with some smart policy seem to be a remedy. So that's why I have some cause for optimism.
When President Bush was campaigning the first time, one of the things that he talked about doing, is one of the things he said he wanted to do, was to cut taxes. And I expect that of all of the things that he talked about doing, this is one of the few that actually he managed to do. And I'm sure if you ask the president, what do you think were your most important achievements, this would be one of the things that he would point to. Now, and I'm sure that there are some number of Republicans that would agree. They do, however, have an expiration date, and there's some question about whether or not these tax cuts will be made permanent. And I wonder what you think about that, and if in fact these expire, that should mean an infusion of revenue when we go back to what it was before. If that happened, then would we then see a significant increase in revenue, and how would that factor into what it is we're talking about?
It's hard to take them as a whole. I think you have to piecemeal them out, and I think politically there's some that are easier to resurrect, if you know what I mean, rather than some others. I think a lot of it depends on what happens in terms of this next presidential election. Certainly, if John McCain is elected, I don't think you will see any of the tax cuts. He certainly right now, in terms of his campaign, saying that he wants to keep them in place. If you have a Democrat, you'll see some pretty dramatic changes. Some of them really do mean some pretty big revenue loss, especially things like the estate tax changes, and that one may be something pretty hard to deal with. I think it's on the one hand, it's an economics question, it's a revenue question, and certainly it would mean new revenues coming into the Treasury, and it would help to balance the budget. On the other hand, it's a political question. It's real easy to cut taxes, and it's real, real hard to increase them. And we found that out, that whenever a political party or an individual goes out and increases taxes, it's been very difficult for them to keep their seat. And a lot of people say President Bush in 1992 was not reelected because he broke his no new taxes pledge.
Yeah, we're talking about the first President Bush, the father of the current President Bush. Yeah,
right. And so and then you look, you track it to the next few years, and President Clinton in his first 2 years, what does he do? Raise taxes, and what happens in the next congressional election? The Democrats lose control of Congress. So politicians are so skittish about doing anything that smacks of raising taxes that even a tax increase that simply goes by the fact of allowing the temporary tax cuts to expire is politically very, very, very difficult to do. And so I'm not very, I don't think optimistic is the right word, but I don't think that there's much political will, barring some other type of tsunami situation, for them to act on most of those temporary tax cuts to restore.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Scott Frisch. He's professor of political science and chair at California State University, Channel Islands. And his areas of expertise include Congress, public budgeting, and public policy. He's the author of the book, The Politics of Pork. Before becoming a college professor, he worked in Washington for the U.S. Department of the Treasury. He was an analyst for the Office of Management and Budget, and also as a legislative fellow for U.S. Senator Frank Lautenberg. And we're talking this morning about the federal budget. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. That's the number for Champaign Urbana listeners here where we are. We do also have a toll-free line. We'll save you the cost of the call. If it be long-distance call, use that number, and that is 800-222-9455. Several callers here locally, starting off with Urbana and line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering what your guests thought about campaign finance reform as a first step toward having legislators be more fiscally responsive. I heard one time on NPR about 2 years ago a retiring senator say that he had to raise $30,000 a week to ensure his reelection. And it seems to me that that has a tremendous influence on how legislators vote. And I'll hang up and listen to your comments.
Mm-hmm. My personal view is I think more important than earmark reform is campaign finance reform. I think that a lot of the reason why so much time, energy, and effort is put in not only by the members of Congress and the senators, but by their staff as well, in securing these earmarks and listening to all the different constituent groups and listening to all the contractors and the cities and the colleges and the hospitals and everything else in their district is because in turn they are looking for support for their campaigns and they're looking for money and they want to make sure that they have a campaign war chest in order to scare off opponents and to run for re-election and to preserve their incumbency. And if you did reform campaign finance, and I think the extreme perspective on there is public financing, you take a lot of that stuff off the table. You take a lot of the incentive for members of Congress to bend over backwards to secure a lot of these type of earmarks. I think earmarks is what I know about in study. I think it's even beyond that in terms of the budget, in terms of responding to interests and issues, and it's I think, a bigger question. Members of Congress want to spend money. A lot of that has to do with the fact that they spend money, they claim credit for it, they make friends and acquaintances and deliver favors in exchange for that. They end up having campaign contributions, and it's a fact of life. Whether they say their votes are influenced by who gives them money or whether they say there's a quid pro quo or a link between campaign contributions and earmarks, the fact is that they get campaign contributions from the same people, groups, organizations, associations that end up getting benefits from the spending of government, including earmarks. So, yeah, my own personal view is that campaign finance reform would be a great first step in terms of cleaning up the process.
Line two is next. Also Urbana. Hello.
Hello. A couple of components of the federal budget are the Afghan war, which is in large part a war on drugs, and we cannot win the war on drugs here in our backyard. So how do we expect to win it halfway around the world? That's one thing I'd like you to comment on. And the second thing is, pardon my French, but if you'd comment on that first one, please.
Well, I think the Afghan war question is kind of beyond the scope of what I do and what I study in terms of budgeting. I think your perspective is a perspective that's out there. There are people who would disagree with you and say it's a war on terrorism issue. I think there are people who say it's somewhere in between. But as far as the budgetary consequences, regardless of what it's being waged for and why it's being waged for, the decision is made and it's costing us money that we have to find somewhere.
How about the budgetary consequences of maintenance of nuclear weapons? I believe we have over 10,000 nuclear weapons. We don't need nearly that many. It seems to me what Eisenhower warned us about the military-industrial complex is alive and well.
Well, if you're looking for the military-industrial complex, it is alive and well in terms of the federal budget. There's no doubt about it. If you look through the defense appropriations bill every year and the defense appropriations subcommittee reports every year, there are billions and billions of dollars that go towards weapon systems, towards contractors, towards some of that money is even earmarked now. So, yes, there's a lot of that. There's a lot of evidence that there's an entire book a guy by the name of Winslow Wheeler wrote about the pork and the spending aspect of defense budgeting. As far as maintenance of nuclear weapons, I think that's a minor kind of spending item compared to a lot of what goes into the federal budget.
And a lot of that money isn't even accountable or accounted for, is it not? I mean, you cannot even audit some of the military.
You can, managers. And if you want to find some of those audits, the Government Accountability Office will put them up on their website, gao.gov, and you can see what goes on there. There is so much money, and frankly, I tend to be a critic of the amount of money that goes to the defense budget, in particular the amount of money that goes in terms of earmarks in the defense budget. As far as auditing it, you can find it. It's just for the average taxpayer, the average citizen, it's really, really difficult to find it and to understand it and to read it and to plow your way through it.
And I appreciate the comments of the caller. I've got some others I want to get to. But just to go back and hit this number one more time, you said earlier, right at the beginning, when we're talking about how the budget breaks down, there's two-thirds of the federal budget that are essentially non-discretionary because they're the entitlements. So that's Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, interest on the debt. And then there's this one-third that's roughly $900 billion that truly is the discretionary part. Defense is part of that. You said about $515 billion, but we mentioned the fact that the paying for Iraq and Afghanistan are special appropriations. They're a separate thing, so that though if you really ask this question, well, what is our defense spending, you really have to add that on. And if you did that, then how much would we be talking about? Do you know that?
I don't know the number off the top of my head, but somewhere between $600 and $700 billion.
Okay, so that one of the things that they have done by making this a special appropriations is that it makes the number, if you just say, well, what's our defense spending, it makes that number look smaller. And in fact, I think it makes it possible for the president to say something like, well, actually, there has been a decline in defense spending, where in fact, that's really not the case.
Well, if you look at the president's own budget, he says from 2001 to 2009, there's been a 70.4 increase in the defense sector, and that's without including the price of the war.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, let's go on to, let's see, another caller, and this would be in Champaign County, line 3. Hello.
Good morning. Is this talk of budget deficits and surpluses kind of illusionary? Because it seems to be done only for political reasons. Now, like, if you look at the actual numbers of the national debt, the last time the national debt went down was in 1957, and it has gone up every year since then. Now, when the Soviet Union fell apart and we had the so-called peace dividend during the Clinton administration, you know, they were claiming budget surpluses and how well he's doing, but the national debt was still going up. So is this just sort of like hocus pocus?
No, I don't think it's hocus pocus at all. I think if you run a surplus, then one of your options is to use that money to pay down the debt, and that's what a lot of politicians advocate. The problem is we haven't run surpluses except for those years that David mentioned. And when you don't run a surplus, you run a deficit. And when you run $400 billion deficits every year, that money has to come from somewhere, and it comes from borrowing, and that borrowing adds to the debt. So it really isn't smoke and mirrors, hocus pocus. It's just in order to get the debt, the $9 trillion debt down, you need to find a way to start paying it off, and that the only way to do that is to run a surplus.
Yeah, but when they have a surplus, they have all this money just laying around, Congress believes, so they just want to spend it on new programs.
Well, the few years in the Clinton administration, there was actually some debt reduction that occurred. It's very tempting for politicians. Politicians get elected by cutting taxes and spending money, and that's part of the hard part of the whole situation, is that when anyone makes a tough choice, people throw them out of office. And so we want everything as a society. We want low taxes. We want lots of government spending. And any politician who either tries to deliver that, whether it's a Republican, the first President Bush, or a Democrat, Bill Clinton, they suffer a consequence.
Well, the national debt as a percentage of the gross domestic product did go down about halfway through the Clinton administration, and then it went up again with W. Bush, but the overall debt itself kept going up.
Well, I appreciate it. I guess we just want to make clear that we are, when you talk about deficit and debt, that's two different things, and that while it was true that during those years of the Clinton administration, those 4 years, we had surpluses, and those were the only 4 years since 1970 that there was no deficit, but that doesn't mean that the debt didn't continue to be a problem during that time.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that we actually had a surplus, and there maybe was some attempt to address the debt issue, but that at that point the debt didn't go away, and that it certainly has continued to go up recently.
Yeah, a few hundred billion dollars in a, you know, at that time $5-6 trillion debt is a kind of a drop in the bucket.
Yeah. Well, let's go to another caller here, Champagne, in line one. Hello.
Yeah. Hi.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of, I don't know, I think it was called IOUs or something against the Social Security. In other words, that Congress borrows against that. Well, how much is that, or what percentage would that be?
Oh, I think it's about $2.4 trillion in total. What happens is each year we create a situation where most of Social Security revenues, most of the money you pay in your Social Security taxes, goes towards current beneficiaries. So the numbers are approximate. They're just out of memory. So we pay in about $900 billion a year, and about $600 billion a year goes right out the door to people who are collecting OASDI, the Social Security program. The remaining $300 billion is basically, they say, it's invested in government treasuries, meaning it is used in the rest of the government, and we write IOUs, and we will pay it back over time with interest like the other debt. So part of our national debt, part of this $9 trillion, is money we owe to ourselves, money we've borrowed from the Social Security Trust Fund. It's not a trust fund per se like other trust funds where it's invested in private securities, stocks, bonds, et cetera. It's invested in ourselves, and by that we mean we use it during the year.
Okay, now what's that total from all those years that they've been borrowing from that?
Oh, yeah, it's somewhere, I think, $2.4 trillion is the current total.
But isn't that part of the crisis? I mean, what happens is that, you know, they're talking about in terms of running out of money. Well, part of it running out of money is that they borrowed against it. Isn't that true? Or what's
well, part of the money is in 2041. That money isn't there anymore. And that means that the entire Social Security program will have to be funded out of that current year's revenues. And what the trustees have said this year is that means about 73% of the total obligations we'll need to pay for Social Security will be available in current year, but there will be no trust fund to draw on. We won't be paying ourselves back anymore. We won't have anything to pay back. And so at that point, you say, okay, what happens? And that's why people are saying we need to fix Social Security quickly. And Social Security, I think I mentioned before, there are fixes that are not as painful as some of the ones associated with Medicare. They do require pain, and that's why politicians have avoided them. But in some way, shape, or form, we need to alter that program as quickly as possible in order to cut the long-term pain of cutting it. The longer you wait, the more expensive it is to deal with.
But also now we bring up the issue of Medicare. That's another one that, that's from my understanding or what I hear, that's the real problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Medicare is a program where medical inflation is outstripping inflation in all the other sectors. And since people are living longer and Medicare is an obligation, it's a promise to pay the medical costs of people who are living longer and at this higher rate as medical inflation increases, the program grows faster and faster and faster than our productivity, the size of our economy, the size of our revenues. And that's why I think it's even a bigger problem because it's much harder to control. The costs are outside the scope of government. With Social Security, we control it because we control how much we pay to people and we control when they retire and how much they pay into the fund. And as far as Medicare goes, a lot of it's outside of our control in terms of what providers charge and what the cost of health care is and the fact that people are living longer and needing more and more in their old age tends to exacerbate the problem.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. This is an area that I think some people say, this is what we really need to be worried about. These two programs, Social Security and Medicare, because as you say, people are living longer and the percentage of the population that's in these older age cohorts, these age groups is increasing. So we know out in the future the bill for these programs is going to get bigger and bigger. And as you say, there it's maybe a little bit easier to do some tweaking with Social Security than it is with Medicare. I guess I wonder, you know, do you think that this is something we're finally going to come to grips with? This indeed may be, again, on this big list of things that the next president really has to deal with. It seems that cost of entitlements is going to be one of those things.
And this is really something that's going to have to take bipartisanship. Both political parties have to sit down and say, okay, the system isn't working. We need to find a compromise that is acceptable to both sides. President Bush tried to reform Social Security, but he didn't get a single Democrat to support his plan, and it was sunk very quickly. His plan called for partial privatization. And it may take some kind of compromise between the Republican ideas of some form of privatization with the Democratic proposals that are out there in terms of the way the trust fund currently taxes people to get things done. I think it's going to have to, in some way, like the last time in 1983 when we had major Social Security reform, be taken out of the political process with a commission. But the commission really needs to have some heavyweights on and who have bipartisan consensus. And I think the next president really needs to deal with this Social Security and this Medicare issue before they get too far out of hand.
We'll try to get at least to one more caller here in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello. Is the problem a Medicare, or is it that medical costs are growing far faster than any other segment of the economy?
Well, I think it's intertwined. I think Medicare is a program that is, in many ways, at the mercies of those costs. And both political parties are recognizing that Medicare is a big problem. Medicaid is as well, although Medicaid has a big state component. They both have the underlying difficulties of dealing with the medical inflation situation. And it may have to be dealt with in some form of comprehensive health care reform. I think both the Democrats are advocating that. The Republican has a different view on it.
Well, the Republicans simply would like to get rid of all the social welfare programs, in my view. But the problem also is we have an economy where the wealth is being increasingly concentrated in a very small portion of the population. And when you talk about controlling Medicare costs, actually what you're talking about is denying perhaps 90% of the public health care.
Well, as far as controlling Medicare costs, there's lots of different options out there, and they are some of them put the burden, the pain on the beneficiary, some of them put it on the provider, some of them share it, and all sides in this are politically active and vocal, and it's very difficult, again, to alter the Medicare program. When proposals are put on the table, the big interest groups, the ones that represent senior citizens, the one that represents the physicians, and people know, I imagine, what I'm talking about, they get very vocal, they get their organizations into full swing, and it becomes politically very, very difficult to do this. And this one isn't an easy problem. And then when you think about all the lobbying and all the interest groups and all the potential harm that it can do to members of Congress, they want to throw up their hands and say, wait a minute.
You have the problem that actually Medicare is far more efficient in its distribution of health care than any of the private insurance solutions. Mm-hmm. So I don't see how privatizing in particular is even a partial solution, except that it would deny health care.
I'm not advocating privatizing or really any reform. I'm just saying that there needs to be a way to find to control the cost of the overall program in terms of its really size in dollar amounts and percentage of the budget, because it is growing rapidly, and medical inflation is the...
Unless we do as the Europeans do and consider it part of the social contract and take it out of the general fund and perhaps trim back our military expenses, which exceed the rest of the world's.
Oh, yeah, there are lots of options, and they're all things that have to be dealt with, unfortunately, from a lot of people's perspective, through the political process, and it's a give and take, it's a compromise, and the way you can have an impact on it, I guess, is to get active, get participate, vote, and be vocal.
We're just about out of time. We have about a minute. I just something we really haven't talked about. Maybe there's not enough time is to talk about the role of the executive here. The Congress has the power of the purse. President can propose, but that's all. And so it makes it sound as if really this issue of spending it really is a congressional problem. But in what way is it also an executive branch problem?
Well, the president puts together the budget, and we hear all this talk about congressional earmarks and spending dedicated by Congress and pork barrel. The president typically does the same thing in terms of his budget. He specifies, if you look at, for just one example, the military construction budget, which funds projects on military bases like housing and fitness centers and things like that. Some of that, and all you hear about, and John McCain and the other Jeff Flake, real opponents of pork barrel spending, get on the soapbox and say, look at all this money Congress is adding to the budget for fitness centers on military bases. But then if you look in the budget, there's almost an equal amount of money that the president already put in there for fitness centers on military bases. And so the president engages in pork politically. Congress does as well. It's been a give and take since the very beginning. It's been something that both branches of government want to have a say over exclusive control, and that's why Congress has been so hesitant, I think, to give up on this idea of earmarking specific projects, is because if they give up, the president will continue to have a big share of it. And that's why when the Republicans took control of Congress in 1994 and they came in saying, well, we're going to get rid of earmarks, they quickly realized that if they get rid of earmarks, then it's Bill Clinton who decides where all the money's spent.
Yeah.
And so they decided, well, maybe it's not such a bad idea for us to have a say on the process. So, yeah, the president is a player in the situation. It's much easier to point at Congress, who adds to the president's proposal, but the president really does earmark projects.
Well, there we're going to have to finish up with thanks to our guest, Scott Fresh. He's professor of political science and chair at California State University, Channel Islands. His interest is in Congress, public budgeting, public policy. He's the author of the book, The Politics of Pork. Professor Fresh, thank you very much.
Thanks, David.